Welcome to the Sustain Nutrition Podcast, Chewing the Fat. Join your hosts, Joe and James, as they share everything they know about mindset, training, nutrition, and self-development, helping you improve with every episode. Now, here are your hosts, Joe and James.
Sustained Nutrition, Chewing the Fat. We have another special guest today, Mr. Chris Tibbetts. We go way back. Chris has got an exceptionally inspiring story, kind of from where you've, well, not where you started, but where you got to your rock bottom to where you are right now. So, Chris, introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about your journey so far.
Thank you, James. Well, my name is Chris Tibbetts. I am a recovering overeater, food addict, whatever label I want to give myself, depending on the day. And yeah, I basically at one stage in my life was eating myself to death. I always used to think I was 34 stone, 7 pounds at my heaviest. But then when I went and did the COVID test and they got my medical records out, they went, "So you were 37 stone, 4 pounds." I was like going, "Sorry, what?" So for all my, I got it wrong around. So yeah, I thought it was 34 stone seven, but I was actually at my heaviest 37 stone, 4 pounds. And slowly eating myself to death to the point that the doctor said, if you don't do anything, you're likely to be dead in 6 months' time through a multiple of whether it's my heart fail, whether I die in my sleep through sleep apnea, whatever, stroke, any of those things were all a possibility at that weight I was carrying. So yeah, I had a problem, and I've had a problem with food all my life. I still have a problem with food, to be honest. I think we all do. We never overcome it. We just have learned strategies and techniques to deal with it. So, yeah, that's me.
You obviously did do something about it, Chris, because you're on the podcast, which we're very grateful for.
Yeah.
Is it 100 kilos that you lost?
More than that, actually. I said 100 because when it was only heavy. So I worked it out from my heaviest to my lightest. So I went from 37 stone 4 to my lightest was 15 stone 8.
Wow.
With an overeating disorder, by the way, which will... and yeah, but then obviously I put weight back on because I was getting ill. It was unsustainable. But yeah, so if you think from that to that, I know it's something ridiculous, like 140 kilos is the max from the heaviest to lightest. But then I realized this error of my ways and balanced out at about 17 stone. So still, 20 odd stone weight loss.
Which is absolutely unbelievable, mate. Unbelievable. Super proud of you. So
yeah.
You mentioned that this has been going on for your entire life. Like, how did it show itself when you were younger? What did that look like? Or how did you do you have an idea of how this started for you?
Yeah, so obviously I've done a lot of work on myself. And through the work I did, I managed to trace it back. So when I was 9 years old, my brother had an accident, a minibus accident at school, was paralyzed from the neck down. And overnight, my life changed and I wasn't put into care, but I was put into the care of family friends. So for 6 months, I lived a lovely family friend, mum called Barbara, and mum's name Barbara's usual, but she was your typical 70s housewife, right? She had the house coat, the pinny, the hair net, everything, right? And her way of dealing with life was food, right? Whether you're happy, whether you're sad, it was food. And obviously, that was quite a traumatic time for me. Didn't see my parents, they were in the hospital, all that sort of stuff. So she used to, give me food. Whatever, she was an amazing cook, amazing baker, but she also had those other traits of, you couldn't leave the table without eating everything, and all of those wonderful traits we put into children, especially at that time. And I think that started it. And then afterwards, once I went back to home, obviously my mum and dad were really busy looking after my brother, and I went to the sweet shop. And guess what? The woman in the sweet shop was really friendly. I went to the fish and chip shop. Guess what? She was friendly. The bakery, And I got this connection with people via food. So it was really in-depth and inbuilt that I'd done this. And obviously the work I've done identified this. And then obviously throughout life, I just did a lot of sport when I was growing up, so I could eat, do everything. And then I just kept eating because I was active. And then when I was about 17, I had a injury where I ripped my ligaments in my knee. So straight away, I couldn't exercise, and but I carried on eating away yet. And I put weight on and then lost weight. And that was the start of my journey. And then throughout my life, I married my first wife. That's a toxic relationship. Still married, we're married for almost 20 years, which is mental. But I had children, and that's a different story. But throughout my life, I yo-yoed. So I'd always, put weight on and I'd lose weight, and I'd put weight on and lose weight. And it was always because I never actually understood about regulating my food. And I always turned to food for comfort until the very end of the relationship, where it was that bad that for me, being big was my protection, being big was my security. And it was just, and it became an identity. And it was all like, oh, well, this is the guy who can, do all the food challenges. This is the guy who, I mean, I'll send the food down to Chris, he'll eat it. We'll never run out. We'll never, when we have a meal, it'll be okay. There's always going to be value for money because, he'll eat everything that's available. So it's all developed along that way, that this sort of food will become an identity. And it's always been there to support me, always been there to never let me down. And it just really sort of became intrinsic to my life.
That's something I see a lot when I speak to, people are either want more information or thinking about joining in the challenges. The frustration that they have that they're making choices that they know they're going to regret because they're intelligent people. But it's that such a, and that journey that you've been on is such a deep-rooted coping mechanism that comes from an emotional reaction. It's not a rational thought. It's very easy for us to talk rationally now and go, oh, well, that's just silly, isn't it? Even if, on like the tiniest scale, well, ironically, is when you see when someone's been dieting and then the scales haven't gone in the right direction, so then they overeat, and now that that's such the exact opposite of what you should be doing, but then they get so frustrated because they're thinking of that with a rational mind when there is such an emotional response. Like you said, it's a comfort blanket. And I was going to ask you, as one of my questions, how much of it became your identity as it's Big Chris. This
Ah,
is
huge, yeah. Yeah, it was, and the worst thing was I spent a lot of time in the northeast of England, right? And they have a thing called a big lad. I was like, oh, yeah, he's a big lad. And it's like, and it became your identity. And it was like, everything about that when I played rugby, it was always like, oh, big Chris, big everything. And I think once that became your identity, it's like, well, you didn't want to let people down, you didn't want to say no. And in my recovery, one of the hardest things was actually having to remove myself from people who kept going, oh, well, have this or do this or eat this. I've done some horrific, food things that I'd never, I got kicked out of McDonald's once for, eating 20 double cheeseburgers, because the manager wouldn't serve us the 20th because he was like, we're putting people off, and barred from a restaurant because I did their steak challenge three times in the, on the bounce. Now it sounds great and funny, but it's like, actually, it's not sensible. It wasn't good. It was a way of connection, it was a way of identity. And for me, it's quite damaging. It was really damaging, but it's the way I found that connection. Again, it comes back to the very, very beginning of being abandoned and all of this, that, I was always seeking this connection. And unfortunately, it came via food. With people, but with people via food.
how much do you feel that your that identity kind of sabotaged your attempts? You said you yo-yoed a few times, because this is again something that we see a lot of times. It's people don't get that identity shift because it's like almost fearful. What if if I become a different person, if I'm not known as Big Chris, like what's going to change? So how much do you feel that impacted your, well, I don't want to
Oh,
say
it was
the
huge.
transformation.
Yeah, no, it was huge. And I think, I'd always struggled with sort of body image anyway. And I think, for me, even when I lost, weight, I still didn't see myself as that. And it was only took me when I had a photo with two other guys who I thought slim, bright, healthy, and I looked the same. And it was the first time I'd ever seen a picture of myself and went, oh God, I look normal. And it wasn't the time I didn't see big Chris looking back at me. I didn't see, fat Chris looking back at me. I saw a normal guy in that photo with all the other people. And again, it was a struggle, and it always has been that seeing this.
With that then, with the photo situation, had you was that the smallest you'd gotten to, or had you seen photos before but not been aware of it?
I'd seen photos before, and I was just wasn't aware of it. So, and I was probably bit back to being bigger at that point. I wasn't at my slimmest at that point, and it was, but I just looked fit. I looked healthy. It was the first time I'd ever seen myself, and I'd been slimmer, and I had lots of photos taken of me looking fit and healthy. I never noticed it. It was the first time I'd actually seen a photo. I went, "Oh,
So how did that happen
who's
then?
that guy?"
Because you said there that you were actually a bit bigger than you had been. So what was the work? Was there work, or was it just was it a natural change? Can you pinpoint why you were able to see that differently?
Probably because I'd actually then accepted that this was my new identity.
Okay.
I think I had actually at this point realized that this is who I was, this is who I am, and I felt this comfort for the first time in a photo that I felt I accepted myself probably for the first time was in that photo that I actually accepted myself, that I wasn't looking at, I wasn't looking for somebody else.
So we talked about your, or you talked about your previous identity as like Big Chris, the guy that could eat. Who was that identity, and is that the same identity you are now?
Yeah, it's still the same. I think the identity I've got now is probably the first time ever in my life at being in peace with myself. So I'm not as healthy. So I was ill. I got ill. It'd be 2 years ago in March, where I had a blood clot in my lung, and it's wrecked my lungs, and I lost the ability to be really physically active, and that affected my mental health as well. So because I've created this new identity of Chris, who's now fit and active and eats healthily and does all these things, and almost overnight I was laid up and I couldn't be fit and active, and I had to. So what I've created now is an identity where I'm actually comfortable that I know I can become fit. I know that my mental well-being is as important as my physical well-being, and that actually food, no matter what I tell myself, food isn't going to be the answer. And where I am now is I probably am a little bit heavier than I want to be because I haven't been as active. I can't be as active as I want to be. But you know what? I'm comfortable with that. The old me would have been like going, I'd either be eating myself into oblivion and going, it's done, or I'd be trying to just do some crazy diet because that's what I used to do in the past.
And I think there's some interesting stuff there because obviously the stuff that you've said there is not always the most relevant to the demographic I imagine that you work with as well. There aren't many women who take a lot of pride in being big eaters, big drinkers. It doesn't really tie into that. But I think one of the identities that we see, and I imagine the same with you, that obstructs health and fitness is motherhood and careers. And those other pieces that people are so wedded to those pieces. What do you see in your clients with regards to identity that limits their progress?
They're always, like you said, they're always too busy, right? They're always too busy, right? Being a mum, a career person, looking after it. And I always say to all my clients, I says, yeah, if we listed everything, right? If we listed everybody in your life, where do you position yourself? And most of them come below the pets in their household, right? And it's like going, well, if you're positioning yourself there and you're giving everything to everybody else, well, no wonder that you will be turning to food for comfort, because the one thing that food never does, right? It never lets us down. If you go and eat that thing, it'll deliver the job. If you eat that junk food, cake, chocolate, whatever your sin is, your vice is, in that moment, it doesn't let you down. Now, you may afterwards, you'll go, oh, you got the shame and the guilt and all the other things kicking in, but that's why they do it. That's why we do it, because that donut works for that fraction of a second that you need it to. And that's the problem, because when you've given everything, you're running on empty, aren't you? If you're running on empty, what are you supposed to do? And it's great people say, well, yeah, you need to go and do that. You need to go, you know, get some exercise in. You need to find some time to meditate. You need to find time to journal. You need to plan your food. And they're like going, but I'm literally, you know, just dropped the kids off at swimming. I've got to go and disc. My mum needs this. My husband's away. You know, the dog at the vets. And you identify that they're not looking after. And that's a problem with me. I'm the worst people pleaser. Throughout my life, I was always putting everybody else first. I put my career first when I was in the corporate job because, you know, I think it's really important. It's really important. But it wasn't important because, you know, as soon as if you're not there, somebody else does the job. I mean, that's the thing.
And that's difficult, isn't it? Because you're then replaced. That's the idea of being replaceable, that actually your identity is not as solid as you think. I think that's such a valid point. I really like what you said about having that awareness about the solidity of your identity, you know, because when it serves you, it's great. And when it's gone, it's gone. There's a rower called Pete Reed. I don't know if you heard Pete Reed's story. He had some kind of spinal stroke and is now, I don't know how his recovery is doing actually. But, you know, as an Olympic gold medalist, the third most decorated rower of all time. And then suddenly to be in a wheelchair. Like, these things happen to people. And I think often people say, well, no, I'm a coach and I'm a man and I'm, you know, partner to my girlfriend. All of those things, well, obviously my gender is going to be harder to shift than the other pieces, you know, to be confirmed on next week's podcast. But you talked about your food intake. That's related to being a man, isn't it? And some of the issues that I would, whilst I haven't fluctuated in weight the same way as you, I've had the same with food and drink. I'm the guy that can eat more and can drink more. And that's cool. That's being a man. That's something that's impressive. And then you are so certain in those stories that it impacts your behavior until eventually something happens. And I guess that's what I want to know now from you and shut up my monologue. When did you realize? What was the moment when you actually stopped and saw the reality of the situation?
It's interesting because obviously I'm in a doctor's surgery being told I've got 6 months to live, right? And you think I'd never go back from that one. You think that would be it. You'll lose weight and you'll be comfortable and you'll never change because you've been told you're going to die. It worked, by the way. I did lose weight. I lost a phenomenal amount of weight. Did really, really well. Left my toxic relationship. I went through this whole period of change and I found the gym. I found health and fitness. I met my new wife and we had a great life in London. And on the outside, you think everything was perfect. You know, I had everything. And I was probably in a really happier place. And then, but what happened is stress came into work, other things. I had lots of entertaining. You know, I've never been I wouldn't never say I'm an alcoholic, but I've played rugby, so I'm quite a big drinker. You know, part of my character, if I drink, I drink. You know, I'm not a 1 pint, 2 pint person. And this is what I said when I used to play rugby. I'd said, look, lads, I'll come out for nights with you, but I'm not drinking because, you know, I can't just have two. You know, so I'd be drinking Diet Coke. And trust me, drinking games with Diet Coke, I'd rather drink lager than Diet Coke because necking pints of Diet Coke is not good. So I think having that identity, you know, for me, even that wake-up call of the doctor telling me to die, yeah, it shook me, don't get me wrong. But then I found myself, I found myself like 4 years later. And there's a photograph of me. Have you ever seen it? I'm on an Airbus A380 and I'm a blimp. I got terrible fashion sense as well. And I looked all, you know, you could see in my face, right? That there's nothing behind my eyes. It's just there's a shadow of a person. And then sort of like four years later, I think maybe 5 years later, and at a award ceremony, and there's this photograph taken me in again, and I'd only got up to 28 stone only, but I could see this picture, and I saw that face, and I looked at him thinking, oh my god, he's back. I thought I'd lost that person, right? And he's there staring back at me in this picture, and I cried. I literally on the train back from Manchester to home, I cried thinking, what have I done? And I realized I had to go and get some help. And for that period of time, my drinking had got out of control. My eating was out of control. Everything was all just a mess. And for some reason, I mean, the next day, I used to live in Sandbach in Cheshire. I used to work in Birmingham. And for some reason, don't ask me why, I went to Shrewsbury for the day. I haven't got a clue. I was going to Birmingham and thought, I can't be arsed going to the office today. So I went to Shrewsbury for some reason, don't know why. And then in the Starbucks. And I was in the Starbucks and I got my usual caramel macchiato, full fat, of course, with the cream on the top as well. And my two cinnamon swirls, because one's never enough. And I sat there and then basically I lost 4 hours of my life. I had my laptop, right? But I lost 4 hours. I don't know what happened. All I know is the drink was empty and the caramel and the cinnamon swirls have been eaten, but I cannot remember this 4 hours. I sort of have lost that period of time. And I realized then that I've got a problem. I really need to fix this. And I went to work about my stress at work and said that I've got this problem. And at the time, I was fortunate because my work had a great private healthcare scheme. So they said, listen, right, we're going to get you some help. So, okay, fine. Went to see this psychologist and they said, we really think you could do some inpatient work. So I'm thinking, right, okay. So I went to a well-known clinic in the south of England. And I can't mention it because I've got a non-disclosure agreement with them, but you can figure out which one it is. And I went there and I survived 3 days before I escaped. I threw a chair in a group session because the therapist there was about 22, never had a donut in her life. And she's trying to talk to me about, well, you need to manage these urges if you've got this urge. And I'm like going, I just didn't understand. And for me, that setting didn't work. So I left and I went and got some sort of further help. But I realized that the food was causing this problem. It was my relationship with food that was the problem. And I really had to sort of break that because I wanted to enjoy food. I enjoy food. And the road I'd gone down before was always restriction, denial, take everything out, and it would be successful because I, my usual go-to diet plan used to be cornflakes and tuna fish and mashed potato, which worked, but that was just restriction. That's all I ate. So I think having to deal with that and confront the fact that I had a problem and I wasn't going to diet my way out of it. I wasn't going to lose, I wasn't going to fix, the diet wasn't going to fix the answer, right? And it was, I had to fix my brain first. I had to fix my mindset first. I mean, I said, you talk about it the other day, James, or you, Joe, where you said, it's your head up. I had to work from the head up because that's where I had to fix the problem because I could lose weight. I'm world class at it. God, if I added up how much weight I've lost in my life, we'd be looking at, hundreds of stones. But the thing is, I was also world class at putting the body weight back on as well. So I think and that was the decision point for me. I realized I had to fix my relationship with food in my head. And that was it. That was that turning point for me. And I think a lot of people make that mistake. They're always looking for a diet. And a diet's not the answer.
And what did that look like then? I mean, I appreciate I don't want you to divulge information you're not comfortable with, but how does that look?
I'm an open book, Joe. I'm an open book.
So what does that look like in practice then? So you've now had this realization, you need to work on your mindset. What do you go and do and how does that look?
So I did several things. I realized that I did need some help. So I joined Overeaters Anonymous from a recommendation for a friend. So I joined Overeaters Anonymous. I went as an outpatient for food addiction. So to look at what foods were triggering. Now, it's interesting when people talk, I hear a lot of people go, oh, I'm addicted to food. You're not addicted to food. This is the thing. People go, I'm addicted to food. Oh, I'm addicted to sugar. You're not addicted to it. You're addicted to the feeling it gives you. But I had to go through this treatment. The treatment for food addiction is very much like an elimination diet. They strip out everything and you start reintroducing food to see how you react to it mentally, not physically, because it's like when you have physical things, and you see how you react physically to it. And that's really tough. And in my withdrawal phase of that, I remember going to see my daughter in Liverpool, and I was walking down whatever the street in Liverpool, the main shopping area, and it felt, no word of a lie, that Ronald McDonald came out of McDonald's talking to me, trying to get me going. The Burger King was there, really. Colonel Sanders was out, and it felt that they're all trying to drag me into the shop. And no word of a lie, it was horrific. And I said to my daughter, I said, I need to go. And I literally ran to the station, got on the train, because I felt this whole compulsion of these people trying to drag me in to eat this food. And when I worked on that, I was like, okay, this is because, I'm so programmed to go and eat these things. And it was just the way they were sort of manifesting in my mind to go, well, you're in Liverpool, you have a Burger King, you have a McDonald's, you have a KFC. And because I wasn't, it was like manifesting it in that way. So what I did is, by then reintroducing the food, I can understand what I know now, what I can eat, what I can eat, and be a little bit, I've got to be mindful of it and what I need to avoid. And the only two foods I really need to avoid is chocolate hobnobs and Domino's pizza, but only Domino's pizza, which got the drizzle around the edge. They put some garlic butter around the edge of their pizzas. If I have the thin base one, they don't put the drizzle on it. But if I have another one, there's something in that drizzle. There's no scientific fact to this, but I cannot eat it. Because if I eat it, I'll eat the whole pizza and I'll be looking for more pizzas. And with chocolate hobnobs, if I have one, I'll have a pack and I will literally go and buy another pack and I'll buy another pack. And I'll be off the rails for about 2 weeks. And it's bizarre. I was spoke to psychologists about it, they can't fathom it out. But I just said, look, but I know it now, so it doesn't bother me. And my life's not the worst for having chocolate hobnobs, but you could put chocolate digestive into me and I'll go, no. If I have a chocolate hobnob, it's just game over.
Would you care to share that experience? Because you mentioned kind of that reintroduction diet. So when you know, one day someone says, try a chocolate hobnob, how does that then look? What happened?
Basically, I just like it felt the hardest way to explain it is it felt like I was like really just and to begin with, it was all chocolate biscuits, and it was only through trial and error, but I felt that I just had this no control over it. And if you look at the ingredients of our knob, it's a bit ridiculous. But what we worked out with is because there was a link with something in the past and hobnobs, it made that connection. And it was like really sort of like there was a connection to the food and some subconscious inside me that made me realize that it was a trigger. So in the same result, like Domino's pizzas was similar. Because I could eat another pizza and I was fine. So this whole working through the food groups, working through, junk food was the hardest because obviously, in a normal elimination diet, you're looking at what makes you bloat and what makes you ill. In this, you're looking at what food triggers that feeling, and it's very much about how you feel in yourself, that euphoria, that high you're getting from that food. And you're having to judge it and manage it and understand how it's feeling, how it makes you feel, your reaction to it, your almost craving. And you're measuring the craving, measuring the feeling, and going, okay. And if you know that you can't understand it, if the craving gets too high, then you know that's a food you have to avoid. But it's really much about understanding it. And people are scared to do that. Because I'm sure you find it. Everyone wants a quick fix. Nobody actually wants to get to the bottom of it. But I knew, and this is part of when I was with the OA people, they were talking about abstinence. I was like going, I don't want to abstain from chocolate biscuits. I like them. I don't want to abstain from, foods that I enjoy just because I can't eat them anymore. Because of something in my head, not because of some they're going to make me ill. And I couldn't accept that. So I had to really look and get a bit deeper into, how do foods react? How do they make me feel? How can I manage that relationship with them better? And it's a difficult thing to do because you're asking yourself to put yourself at the mercy of your feelings. You know, you got your almost deliberately, what, you know, I'm going to do a drug addict, but you're deliberately trying to, you know, patch yourself out.
Yeah, I think what I was really, that's really interesting, because there's the acceptance around not having the things that you want. There's the acceptance about losing the identity that you had before. I was interested whether it was like you stumbled across it almost with the chocolate hobnobs. You know, you had one and then it became a pack and two packs, and then you went, oh God, this happened again. Or whether you had one and went, oh my gosh, this is different to the chocolate digestives.
I was able to recognize that. I knew I had a problem with them already, right? But because I could eat, because previously I'd eaten lots of biscuits anyway, a pack of biscuits would go on regardless of whether, except rich tea, never ate rich tea, disgusting. Almost up there with mince pies, James.
How dare you?
But yeah, so I did notice it, but I'd also noticed that when I had a chocolate digestive, as an example, and this is the test they gave me. Yes, I wanted more because I was greedy, right? Because they were nice, but there was no reaction. But when I had a chocolate hobnob, I had the second biscuit in my hand straight away, and that was the sort of test they did. Is like, you know, it's a bit like that urge surfing. You sit there going, looking at, going, oh, I don't want it, I don't want it, I don't want it. And well, the chocolate, I said, like, yeah, I want, I'm going to have another one, but I'm okay. The hobnob was, taste it, I needed another one straight away. That need, rather than want. I was like, I need another one. And it was that feeling that I could identify. Now, to begin with, everything felt like that. You know, it was like, whenever I had chocolate, like, I need more chocolate. But what I say to people, when you sit and pause and wait, you realize that need, it, that you're wanting it, you don't necessarily, you know, you've got to sit with that pause. And I knew with a hobnob that I couldn't sit with the pause. I just had another one, you know, I couldn't stop.
No more questions, John. I'll let James ask something.
No, when you were saying that, I was thinking, like, oh, I wonder how much of this is coming from a belief that if I eat Domino's, I can't stop, you know, or if I eat chocolate hobnobs. You said it's something that's from the past, that's an association, because if it's not a physical, I need to have this to survive, then often, and I know it's on a much smaller scale to, you know, what's happened with you, is we see that with people, and it's like, well, when I'm driving on the M1, I always stop at Burger King and I always order this, or, you know, people go like, well, my kid wanted McDonald's, so I got a Big Mac, large fries, and this. Like, well, you could have ordered something else. Like, well, that's what I always order. Like,
yeah,
that's much more habitual, but it's almost like, oh, I believe I have to do this, or, you know, we're having a weekend away, so I have to eat crap all weekend because that's part of the experience. So what did that journey
a
look
lot of
like
it is the same.
Goes all right.
No, I was gonna say, and that was a lot of the work I did on myself, was this whole, the limiting belief or the stories I told myself that goes, you know, well, I am the guy who has, you know, an extra large value meal. I'm the guy who has an extra large fish and chips. I am the guy who has a 12 inch piece and not a 10 inch piece. I am the guy who has two donuts rather than one. You know, it was an identity. And again, it's like, well, every time I go to McDonald's, you know, well, if the kids have me, I'm going to have it regardless if I'm hungry or not. You know, and I think people kid themselves into this going, well, you know, we always do this, but it's like, I had to strip it back and go, well, you know, what am I telling myself? This is what I said about the mindset piece. You have to understand how it's impacting your beliefs and how, you know, and also where they've shaped from. So for me, you know, even deep down now, that for me, loving, you know, for me to get love and connection with people, it came through food because of what happened in my childhood, you know, because, you know, when the baker is always friendly, you know. And if you think about it, if you go to a coffee shop now, 9 times out of 10, they're friendly to you because they ask your name, they speak to you, don't they? You know, and I think that's the thing that deep down, that was that connection I'd always been looking for. And I found it with food. I thought it was with food, but I wasn't. I was looking for the connection with people. It just manifests itself via food.
I think this is where it's so hard as well. And I think, I was thinking something similar to James, in that, you know, would it be physically possible for you to master Domino's and hobnobs? Probably, but there's certainly a point here where it's like, there's just so many foods to tackle. And if you look at every other addiction, smoking, gambling, sex, porn, all these other things are so much easier to cut out of your life. Whereas the volume of triggers with food is so high, it's the most socially acceptable, you know, financially available, immediately gratifying, super consistent. You know, it's the, a very, really potent mix. And actually, for you to recognize, you know what, this is over that level that I can manage. As you said, chocolate hobnobs, no, this isn't an essential ingredient for life. This isn't going to massively impact you. So it's that differentiation between what can I moderate and what can't I moderate. And I think that that allowing yourself to do that is such a good point of having that self-awareness to go, this feels different. This little, this extra bit is too hard for me to manage. And so actually it makes more sense to cut it out. So yeah, fair play to you. Very interesting.
And again, it's interesting as well in my recovery. So obviously you work with a lot of family, you know, a lot of busy mums and families and all of this. And, you know, the traditional advice is, well, don't have any of the stuff in the house, right? That's great. But well, that's unfair on everybody else. You know, and I know, you know, you shouldn't have to give your kids chocolate or biscuit or anything, but they're in the house. You know, it's part of our, it's part of what we have in the house these days. Right? Even if you have them in moderation. So they're there. And I said to my wife, I said, well, look, it's not unfair for you. So I said, I don't like crunchies, right? I'm not a fan of double deckers. I'm not, you know. So what we did to find a way around was we found things that I didn't particularly like, but they liked, right? Because then actually, if doing that, I'm not going to, if I eat them, I'm binging, right? And if I eat them, my wife and daughter are going to know about it and they'll be calling me out on it. And I think identifying that and making that easier. So there's still something in the house for them, but then I could go, well, that's not, I don't like them, right? If I decide I'm eating them, if I caught myself in the cupboard with a crunchy bar, things would have to be really desperate because I can't stand them. I think it made it that easier, putting that barrier in the way of going, I'm not having them not in the house, because if I strip them out, then I'm admitting that I've got this problem, which I know I've got, but then I'm making everybody else around me suffer for it. And I don't think that's fair. And it helped my recovery quicker than having nothing in the house.
It's a great idea, a great technique, because I totally agree with you when people are like, just don't have it in the house. Like, well, that's easy if you live on your own or you live with one person who doesn't enjoy those foods. But like you said, I'm really conscious, like my son's, Magnus, he's 4.5. I want him to grow up with a great relationship with food. Like I've got a good one, I'd say. I'm a terrible plate clearer. I have no recognition of when I'm full or not. I just go until my plate's clear. And that's definitely something from childhood. But I wouldn't want him growing up thinking chocolate's bad or cake is bad. Or I want him to grow up with a normal relationship with food, and he stops when he's full, and then he can eat some chocolate if he wants, you know, and he's really good at moderating stuff. You know, we gave him chocolate at Christmas, and you find it on the side. He's like, I've had enough of that. I'm good. There's no binging or emotional eating or anything like that. And yeah, I think that idea of putting a bit more friction between those choices, like, oh, if I'm eating this chocolate that I don't like, then that is a massive red flag for me. But for those people around me, I think it's a really good kind of midway thing there. Yeah, great idea.
And again, it's just, and it all comes from just understanding that, you know, again, you know, my wife's awful in a way because she's got a terrible relationship with food, right? She's got a terrible eating habit. She doesn't, you know, she'll go all day and not eat, or she'll eat rubbish food. But it's not my, you know, so in terms of support, she's the worst person for that sort of thing because she can't follow a plan. But what was great was she was happy to support me in my process and my choice. You know, I think that was really important because if I didn't have that, then I'd have been struggling. You know, one of the reasons that I had a problem previously in my first relationship, first wife, was because she controlled people with food. You know, she fed, she came from family feeders, but she fed. And for her, it was like all about manipulation and using food for that. And, you know, you can see the impact, you know, with the family and how that impacted them. So I think that balance is really important.
And it is tough, isn't it? Because often it's coming from a good place, your exercise. Yeah. You know, like I think when I went to my mum and dad's for dinner last night and She gave Magnus like a banana and he wanted some cream on it. And then she put some sprinkles on it. Like he didn't ask for sprinkles, but she just like, that's kind of like a little love bombing. Like, oh, I'm going to do this because he's going to really, really enjoy it. And I get enjoyment from seeing him enjoy it. So I think, you know, even going back to, was it Barbara you said who you lived with?
Barbara, yeah, Barbara,
It's
yeah.
all coming from a good place, you know, like, oh, you've
Oh,
fallen off. Like,
absolutely. Yeah.
but
And
it's doing damage.
a lot of people said, well, were you ever resentful of your parents? I was like, going, hell no. God no. It's like they were in an awful, difficult position, right? And I was immensely grateful to Barbara for everything she did, to my parents, because it was difficult for them, right? And I managed that situation. Thankfully, I managed to work everything out and wait till my 40s to fix myself. But I did. It just took time, and it's hard work. It's like you said. I love Joe. You said about the Olympic athlete getting ill. I had got to this point in being physical and active and doing triathlons and playing rugby in bloody my late 40s and all of that. And then all of a sudden, for the first time in my life, I'm fit and healthy. And I can, I was like hours from death with this blood clot on my lung, and it damaged my lungs. I'm thinking, for crying out loud, I finally got a grip on my life, and I'm in bed. And then, of course, what had happened is I still ate like I was training. I still did all these things, and weight gradually comes on. Now, what happened is I didn't turn to binge eating. Yeah, did I? Have I overeaten? Yes, I've because you had to overeat because I put weight on, but. It's like, but in my head, I've got this acceptance. Like I said before, I've got this acceptance going, it's all right, because the person I would have been before, the wheels would have come off. I'd have given up and said, this is ridiculous, and I can't do anything. Whereas now it's like, no, I've got all the tools. I'm on the road to recovery. It's going to take time, but I'm 52. I've got another potential 30 odd years left on this planet. So it's a hell of a long time to go jacking it in for now and, giving up on everything.
Brilliant. Yeah. What a journey, mate. Did you find that second identity shift a lot easier than the first one then?
Was a lot easier. A
How's
lot
it
easier than
helped?
the first one. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, good stuff. Super interesting. Thank you very much.
No, you're welcome.
Just if this has resonated with someone, if someone's found themselves in a similar position to you, what one piece of advice could you give them?
The first piece of advice I'd give anybody in this situation is to accept and admit that acceptance, the admitting that a diet's not going to fix this, right? I mean, you guys say this on all your posts, right? It's like, if I where I am now, what I did previously didn't work, right? So I've got to understand what's driving my behavior. So if I accept and admit that I've got a problem, right, then that's the starting point, and if that problem is with food, right, then seek that help, right? And it is there, but a diet's not going to fix the answer. You, like we said, you've got to fix the mindset. So acceptance and admittance is the first step. Like any problem, you've got to treat yourself as if you've got a problem with food, then you accept it. And I think you probably work with a lot of people who probably need a bit of just motivation, a bit of support. Some people have real problems with food, real problems with relationship with food. And if that is that problem, the more you try to hide it by dieting or buying a fad plan or going to
You could say it. You could
Weapon
say
World
it,
or whatever
Chris,
they
if you
call it,
want.
go to Slimming World or Weight Watchers or whatever, them bloody terrible charlatans, then that's not going to fix it. I think that's it. And I think once you've done that, and then share that you've got a problem. A lot of this is like embarrassment. But if you've been, if you're, I'm, I've never been a woman, so I don't know. But I know from my perspective, my wife used to go, "You need to wait again, are you?" Oh, there we go then. What was it this week? What was it this time? You've got to be open about it and go, "This diet's not working for me. I've got this problem, and I'm going to need your help and support." And like we said, if somebody goes, "I've got a drink problem," everyone's like, "Oh, okay, I'll help you. Oh, there's no booze. Get rid of the booze." But whenever they go, "Oh," people just go, "Don't eat it." It really frustrates me. Go, "Well, have a bit of willpower. Just don't eat it." But you never say that. You'd never offer an alcoholic a vodka, would you? And go, "Just don't drink it."
Totally agree. That's what kind of gets me going with everyone just going, it's just calorie deficit. Like, that's really useless information for someone if they struggle with why they're eating and not what they're eating. But brilliant, mate.
Yeah, calorie
Absolutely.
deficit's absolutely great.
Yeah, if you can stick to it. Inspirational story. Now, Chris, if people want to find out more about you, where can they find you?
On Instagram at Emotionally Eating Coach UK, or on my Facebook, Emotionally Eating Coach UK. Just search that, you'll find me. And yeah, just reach out, have a conversation. That's, that's the first step, is just having a conversation about it. I think it's, everyone needs to do that. The more we talk about it, the more we're open about it, then I think the more we can actually get a handle on this, because I think people just need to stop hiding from it.
Brilliant. Awesome, mate. Thank you. Truly
Awesome.
inspirational story. Thank you.
Appreciate that,
You're
Steve.
welcome.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did and you'd like to help support it, please share it with others. And if you didn't, please feel free to send it to someone you don't like. Until next time.